Okay, so
here with P mu, here this is the 4 momentum, and this is the 4 velocity v, or actually the 3 velocity v, dx, I, dt. And the zeroth component of the 4 momentum is just dt e lambda, which is the same thing as corresponds to energy. And this would be 3 momentum, which is just basically ends up looking like energy times velocity. Because effectively, PI would be the same thing as taking dx dt times dt d lambda to get the dx d lambda. So this makes sense that this is basically energy and momentum, right? So what we could do is we can use the geodesic equation and look at what happens when you're following a geodesic through a perturbed space-time. And you can see here the geodesic equation in general is written like this, but we can also take this dp d lambda and change it to a dp dt and divide through by the energy term. And you can see all we did was just change the number in the denominator here. And then if you take the mu equals zero term, then what that gives you is sort of the evolution equation for energy, because it's just taking the time derivative of p0, which is this, and you can see that you get this whole thing, which actually says that your energy is actually evolving with time. It's not just conserved energy. And you can see that it depends a lot on time derivatives of the scalar, vector, and tensor components of the perturbation and velocity. And you can do the same thing with the time change in momentum, and you can get something like this.
So what that tells us is that we really don't have conserved energy and momentum and like we would normally be used to. And also we have this thing, the gravitational electric field, which comes from basically taking this perturbation and doing something that looks a lot like the electric field. Because remember, when electric field classically, the electric field would classically looks like you're taking the partial derivative respect to zero of AI minus partial I A zero, right? Where these are the vector potentials, and this is the this would be in the I direction. So what we do is we do our perturbations the same way. We can see this is the zeroth component of the perturbation, and this is the vector component, the I component of the perturbation. So the vector perturbation terms take the place of the vector potential. The scalar perturbation term takes the place of the scalar potential. So it's kind of cool. So you actually get something that looks like the electric field, but with gravity. And you can even do a gravitational magnetic field.
And both terms have a negative sign.
Right. Yeah, it's a little different. But you can also do something that looks like the gravitational magnetic field, where you have this cross term between the vector potential. And so it's the curl of the vector potential. And this looks a lot like a magnetic field where you're taking the curl of the vector potential. And that's the same thing as this. And so what happens is when you use these gravitational, electric, and magnetic fields, you can rewrite this time change in the momentum in terms of these fields. And you can see here you've got the time evolution of momentum is like energy, and then there's this gravitational electric field and this cross term with a magnetic field. And so this looks a lot like a Lorentz force, right? And this tells you how particles respond to scalar and vector perturbations. And then this other stuff really just deals with the gravitational waves, because these are basically just tensor perturbations. And so between the two of these, you get to some really interesting stuff, understanding the dynamics of the particles. And so the idea behind this was, if we can make gravitational equations look more like electrodynamics. We already know a lot about electrodynamics. We know how to handle a lot of the math there. Then we can understand a lot more about what's happening in gravity. And that's actually one of the approaches they use in quantum gravity. And see, the reason why you chose gravitino-electric and gravitino-magnetic was basically because scalar and vector perturbations look like, you know, scalar and vector potentials. But when you get to these tensor perturbations, it's a whole different ballgame.
And all the terms on the right-hand side of that equation would all be different components of the force.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, each one of these would basically be like equivalent to different components of the force. Because this is, by definition, force, dpi dt. So these all have to be force. And so you get force that comes from all these different things. And so what this says is that if you have a particle and it's sitting in the space-time, and the space-time becomes perturbed, the particle will move and respond to it. And this is how it's going to move and respond. Which is kind of what you'd expect, because otherwise, you know, if you have a particle sitting there and space-time starts moving, you don't expect the particle to just act like it's not moving. But this is actually getting into dynamic relativity, which is something you just don't see in a lot of other physics. Now, we can also, in order to find out more about what's going on with these particles, like basically this whole thing here was taking the geodesic equation and trying to simplify it down to where we could understand a little bit about the particle motion. What we're going to do from here is actually look at Einstein's equation, which is much more complicated, and try to simplify that down and see if we can learn a few things about particle motion from there, and about how they affect the space-time and so on. So we linearize Einstein's equations, and I skipped about a billion steps here and got down to the G00, the G0i, or G0j, and the Gij terms in each one. And you can see here, they're all essentially derivatives of the scalar, vector, or tensor components. And so you'll notice that if you use the full Einstein's equation here, it's going to show you that most of the metric components are going to end up being constraints and not degrees of freedom. And here's what they mean by that. You take, for example, G00 term, which is G00 here and the T00 term over here. And you plug that in with that G00 term here. And what you'll see is that you get something that looks like a Poisson equation for psi, where it's saying the Poisson equation for psi on the right-hand side, you've got the G00, or the T00 term, and then you've got this stuff involving the strain equation, second derivative of the strain. So what happens is, if you know the strain, and you know the T00 part of the stress-energy tensor, which is like density, then that fixes what happens to the scalar perturbation. So your scalar perturbation is constrained by doing that. You can't just have whatever scalar perturbation you want, whatever strain you want, in whatever space-time you want, or energy density field. You look at the next one involving the zero I terms, or zero J terms,
And what you get here is an equation on the left-hand side, which fixes the vector potential in terms of stress-energy tensor components, which are going to be kind of defined. The scalar potential term, which is going to be sort of defined up there, and the strain term. The only thing that you're not really defining here is you notice that here, this is a Laplace equation, so it doesn't really say anything about the time evolution of psi. It just defines what it looks like in space. And this only defines what the vector potential, or the vector perturbations look like in time, not necessarily in space. So outside of the time derivatives, everything's kind of fixed. And then you look at this next one. Or sorry, the first one, psi is not the thought of the scalar perturbation. I think of it as a scalar perturbation because it usually ends up being used like one. But it's really the trace terms. The scalar perturbation term, here it's defined in terms of the stress energy terms and then all these derivatives on psi and the vector potential and the tensor strain perturbation parts. And so you could see from all this that the only thing that you can't, that is really free to be defined is a strain. So the strain has degrees of freedom. None of the other perturbations do. So that means that if you define what the strain is, then that's going to define what all the other perturbations are. And then you've got, you know, what's your full perturbations are going to look like. And so we define strain. Now, we have all these different gauge choices that we can apply. And this is sort of going back to what I said earlier about gauge choices, where we can just add on a gauge, and depending on what gauge we add on, it makes the math easier. But it doesn't really affect our overall equations. And so the gauge choices that you have is that for the scalar perturbations, you can add on a time derivative of zeta here, the time component of zeta. For vector perturbations, you could add on this term, which is kind of like the gravitino-electric field. And then for the trace term, you can subtract off the trace of the derivative of zeta. And then for the strain, you've got this term, which is just kind of symmetrized with zeta. So this is just like taking this Lie derivative of the metric. And then you've also got this other term, which actually looks like the trace of zeta. So all these together are going to give you gauge choices, and then once you have the gauge choices, then you can define exactly what you're dealing with. So the first gauge we're going to talk about is a transverse gauge. And that's the gauge where if you take a divergence of the strain, you're going to get zero. And so in order to get to that gauge, it basically means you have to set up zeta like this. And so you define zeta, and then that necessarily gives you the strain gauge. And so you can determine all the components, the spatial components of zeta, using this relationship. But then for the time component of zeta, that's going to come about by just simply taking the divergence of the vector perturbation. Because if that vector perturbation term goes to zero, and that vector perturbation term has to go to zero, because, where is it? You could see here that, you know, you can look at this equation here and see that, well, if the strain goes to zero, then what does that say about the vector perturbation? And then you can also look here and you can see that, well, that this necessarily has to drop out, then what you get is divergence of that has to go to zero,
And if the divergence of that goes to zero, then that tells you that you must be in this gauge. Where if you take the Laplacian of the time component of zeta, it's going to be equal to this. And so you've defined the zeta, which gives you that perfect gauge. And that lets you do a gauge transformation. And then you notice if you put this gauge in, then, and you know zeta, you can now take zeta and use it to redefine all of these perturbation terms. And then once you have those new perturbation terms, you can define all the metric terms, or all the Einstein tensor terms. And what you get is much simpler. The G00 term is just this 2 times Laplacian of psi. And the G0J term is just a Laplacian of J plus this other term involving a derivative of psi. And then the GIJ term, you'll notice this term where you have these second derivatives on psi and phi, you've got your derivatives on the vector perturbation, you've got your derivatives on psi, and you've got a box derivative on the string.
I have a question.
Yeah.
That GIJ, not that I understand math notation, you've got a parenthesis around your two scalars, phi and psi.
Mm-hmm.
Did you mean to have that closed bracket there?
Yeah. Because, remember, this all applies to both scalars.
Oh, even the Laplacian for the name?
Yeah. Yeah, it applies to both scalars, not just the phi.
Okay.
What ends up happening is that if you, you'll notice that none of your perturbations can actually get through to becoming part of the Einstein tensor without having some derivative on it. And it kind of goes back from the fact we're using linearized space, and so all the Riemann tensor terms are going to involve second derivatives. So everything, every one of your terms, you notice, is going to be a second derivative in the perturbation. The only good thing in physics is that you know, you rarely have to deal with anything higher than second derivatives, but the second derivatives are going to show up. Okay. Now, the other gauge we want to talk about is the synchronous gauge. And the synchronous gauge is basically where you're going to take the scalar perturbation to zero, which means that the time derivative of the zeta time term is going to be equal to the scalar potential. And that means also that the vector potential is going to go to zero, or vector perturbation, which can give you the other terms here for the zeta. And what that means is that your scalar and your vector perturbations have both disappeared in this gauge, and you're left with just the tensor perturbations.
For your metric?
Mm-hmm. And so now you're just rewriting the metric just in terms of those tensor perturbations.
Why is it called synchronous?
I guess because there is no time perturbations anymore.
Okay.
So as far as it's concerned, time perturbations disappear. And I don't think they actually wrote down the metric to show you exactly what the metric for the transverse gauge looked like. But they didn't show the Einstein equation. I think the idea of the transverse gauge is mostly where they want to show you how it simplifies the Einstein equations to make it a little bit easier to solve. All right, so any questions with this stuff so far? Most of the stuff we're going to get to from here on out is going to be kind of like applications of this perturbation stuff.
What is the zeta?
Zeta is some vector. It's
your gauge transformation.
It's your gauge transformation vector. It's some vector that makes magic happen. And then when the magic happens, then you can move on with life. Okay. All right. Now, the next section he got to, his title for it was Newtonian Fields and Photon Trajectories. I call it gravitational lensing because, you know, to me, they're really not that different. This is on page 286. And what you'll find is that there's this section on which is basically the fundamentals of gravitational lensing, and then there is a much more in-depth discussion of gravitational lensing in Chapter 8. And you can almost just take the two and stick them together in order to get a really good understanding of it. But they use a lot of cosmology concepts in the other one, which don't make a lot of sense here. The basic idea here is to just understand this basic gravitational lensing by looking at perturbed space-time. And so what they're going to do here is they're going to use the Newtonian limit, which is basically saying you make gravity weak. But here, in the Newtonian limit we're going to talk about here, it's going to be weak gravity, but you're going to have test particles that can move at any velocity, where normally the Newtonian limit also means you slow down particles so they're moving at non-relativistic speeds. And then also we're going to use dust here. They call it different things. I always call it dust, where you have a stress energy tensor for a particle which doesn't really have any pressure. So you can see that the rho term here exists, but then the other diagonal terms go to zero. And we have the transverse gauge we're going to use. And in the transverse gauge, which we talked about before, your Einstein equations simplify. So your Einstein equations are going to simplify down to this. So the psi and W equations you can solve by just basically solving the Poisson and Laplace equations, which we know how to do. And once we've solved those two, we can essentially use the solutions to those to solve this other equation involving the strain. Now, we've got a few requirements for what we're going to do. One is that any solution that we come out with has to be non-singular and well-behaved at infinity. Now, what that means is that if you think back, we're talking about Laplace and Poisson equations, right? And the Laplace and Poisson equations, they describe a point charge. Or like the Laplace equation might describe a point charge, which is basically described by a delta function at the origin, and then everywhere else it drops off to zero. And the Poisson equation will describe basically something like that. And what happens is that's going to be singular at that point. We don't want that to happen. So W has to be equal to zero. Otherwise, we end up getting that singularity. So WI, the vector perturbation, has to disappear to zero. That simplifies things a lot. Because if this is zero, then it's got to be well-behaved at infinity also. And since it has to be well-behaved at infinity, that means that as you, for psi, if you want this thing to be well-behaved at infinity, the perturbations have to disappear, which tells you that this term, or the relationship between these two terms, has to also disappear. So we have phi is equal to psi, so the scalar perturbation is the same thing as that trace term. And also we have to have that the Laplacian of Sij has to go to zero because, again, if it didn't, then we would have this singularity at the origin, which is not allowed. So basically all of our Laplacians, everything that's in a Laplacian has to disappear in order to avoid singularities. Everybody understand that? Okay. Well, think about it like this. I mean, the only way I could think about it is, in my mind, I just imagine we have a point charge. We call them plus. And we describe them by Q delta
of x. And if we take the Laplacian and say this is equal to rho, take the Laplacian of rho, we get zero.
And so the only way to avoid, but that means, though, that if we plot it, rho versus position, then it looks like this, but much sharper. The only way to avoid having that singularity would be to set rho equal to zero everywhere.
But if rho is a constant?
Well, then it doesn't satisfy the Laplace equation. Well, it could be a constant, but it has to be a constant zero.
Oh, yeah, you're right.
Because as you go out to infinity, if it's a constant, it's going to have to be that constant everywhere.
Yeah.
And so the perturbation has to disappear at infinity, so therefore the only constant that works is zero. So you notice here, this is a Laplacian of psi. This is essentially a Laplacian of psi, but it's not zero on the right-hand side. So this is a Poisson equation instead. This is a Laplacian. Here's a Laplacian of this. Here's a Laplacian of that. And so all these have to, everywhere you see a Laplacian, it has to disappear. Otherwise you have, what?
No, except the first one, the psi is not zero.
Yeah, because it's really not. And basically, the way we interpret that is that that first equation really doesn't tell us anything about physics of what's going on. So if phi and psi are equal to each other, then that gets rid of this part of the equation. And then if Sij is equal to a constant zero, then that gets rid of this part of the equation. So it's satisfied, assuming that those are all true. And so the only piece of information we really get out of this is that phi is equal to psi. And if phi is equal to psi, then this is our metric. And our perturbation is literally going to just be equal to this. It's just 1's going down the diagonal multiplied by 2 phi. Because it's only diagonal terms that are even affected here. And so our whole equation we have to solve is just this. Because that's the only equation that we do. Yeah, that's left. Everything else we pretty much eliminated. And so our potential is just this potential, which just looks like a gravitational potential, which ends up being solved by, basically saying we take the second derivative of psi and it gives us this. So it just goes like the 1 over r potential. And so if we write our geodesic of this thing, then what happens is, it's just a Newtonian potential. And so the geodesic is basically the path that we take, and we take this unperturbed path, and then we just assume we can just add a perturbation onto the path, and which we parameterize with lambda. And that gives us the full path. So in other words, this unperturbed path is what would happen if the potential were to shrink away to zero. The full path is the one where we have, this perturbation in it, and a perturbation in the metric leads to a perturbation in the path. Simple, right? So if we assume that if we take this term, which is basically saying we're going to take a gradient of the potential, and then we're going to take and we're going to multiply that by the perturbation. So it ends up taking a gradient in the direction of the perturbation. That's going to be much smaller than the scalar perturbation is. In other words, the perturbation up here is going to be tiny compared to the full path. And the potential varies only slightly along the true geodesic. So you can assume that effectively, even though you're going on a different path, the potential that's going to be exposed to is pretty much the same. Then what you get is this figure from page 288 in the book, which is where you have light coming in from a source. This is supposed to be somebody's eye. And what happens is this light would normally come straight in from the source to the eye, and it would pass by the source at some impact parameter. But instead, what happens
is light from the source, which would go off at this other angle, because of this curvature of space-time, actually ends up getting curved around the source and back towards the eye. So light ends up following this path to get to you rather than that path that's straight across.
And it appears that it's at a different angle.
And it appears that it's coming in from a different angle. So in other words, you see it as if it's up here, but really it's down here.
So that's when the sun sets and it looks so big?
No.
That's the mass of the Earth?
No. This would be like... when they did this as an experiment, this is one of the first experiments to test Einstein's theory of general relativity. And the perturbation that they saw was tiny with the sun in a total eclipse. So you're talking about something that was on the order of... I think they actually say in here that this was the experiment that they tested... And I want to say it was like 1919 when they witnessed a solar eclipse.
292.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, and so this was 1.75 arc seconds was the maximum deflection angle for our sun. So the Earth, which is 1,000 times smaller, wouldn't do anything, really, as far as the gravitational lensing effect. And they kind of... debated later on about whether or not that observation was actually even accurate enough to even tell if there was a gravitational deflection. So it's a pretty small effect. What happens is, we use this in astronomy and in astrophysics, is if you take a galaxy and you have an entire galaxy and light comes by the galaxy, a whole galaxy will bend it. And so this could be, M here could be a galaxy, and this could be some distant light source, like another galaxy or star. And then as this galaxy passes between us, you'll actually see this other galaxy appear to move. And so you'll see it up here instead of down here. And then they also have this thing called an Einstein ring, where light will get deflected on both sides. And you'll actually see two images. And so it's really cool stuff. But what it ends up telling us is it tells us more about this mass here, which is deflecting the light, than it does about what we're seeing. All right, so to understand what's going on here a little bit better, we're going to break this down. And we're going to define these two vectors. One is going to be K and one of them is going to be L, where K is going to represent the derivatives of the path, with the unperturbed path, with respect to some parameter. And L is going to represent the derivatives of the perturbed path with respect to some angle. And we're going to use the fact that these are traveling along null geodesics. And you know that these are unperturbed here, the full path. And so the zeroth order, you could see that when you contract the K with itself and you're going along this null geodesic, you should get zero. And that means that minus the time components of K squared and the spatial components of K are going to be equal to each other. We could say K0 squared is the same thing as KI. KI squared is equal to K. Now, the first order, when we start adding in some perturbation, what we're going to look at is the cross turns between K and L. And you'll see here, you've got this perturbation with the flat space-time metric term here. And then you've got the perturbation, and you've got the two unperturbed paths here. And so you can crunch all that out and see that, you know, the perturbation, you know, here goes like 2 phi. So this ends up being the equation relating those two. And you notice we have the time-like components and the space-like components. Everything's related.
I think I dropped a... actually, it doesn't matter. But we could put this as K0. It doesn't really matter, since it works either way.
All right, so now we have this, and now we figure out the Christoffel symbols. And the idea is we figure out the Christoffel symbols because we want to construct the geodesic equation.
So the Christoffel symbols come directly from the metric here. And then you could see that the geodesic equations end up as this. So we've got the geodesic equation L sub mu, or sorry, lambda, and then you've got which you break up into the L0 and LI terms. And so these are the paths, you know, for this vector just broken up into each individual term. And you can see that these, using the Christoffel symbols, are now written in terms of the k's and the perturbation, or the scalar perturbation. And so this you can solve because all you have to do is take this and integrate it over lambda. And so you integrate this over here, and you end up with just minus 2k phi from this equation. And the other, and so since you know from up here that this relationship is true, then if you know L0, you can solve for this cross term between these two, which is equal to this. And so all we did was we took this equation and we rewrote it here. And what we get out of this is that this is equal to zero, which means that these two vectors have to be perpendicular to each other. So that means that the perturbation is going to be perpendicular to the path, which is exactly what we see here. The perturbation is along this direction, the path is along that direction. You can also see that alpha, which is this angle that you can see here, which is the angle between you know, these two arc paths, is going to be equal to delta L over K. And delta L you can calculate by just integrating dl d lambda, which comes from integrating this whole equation here. And where I've defined here this perpendicular gradient to be taking the gradient of phi, but then subtracting out the parallel components of the gradient, which is just coming from all these k terms. And so you take this, then you divide through by k, and you get this term. So it's alpha is equal to that.
K is the unperturbed path?
Actually, K is the unperturbed path. Actually, I think I'm missing a squared term. Yeah, actually, you know what? I think this is supposed to be squared here. Never mind. The reason why it's not squared is because when we integrate, we change from d lambda to ds. And the ds is equal to k lambda. And so that's how we got rid of the k. Because that alpha is supposed to be dimensionless after we do all this. So we want to make sure it's dimensionless. All right. Now, if we use the Newtonian potential, phi equals minus gm over r. And from geometry here, you can say, you can write r in terms of the impact parameter b and the unperturbed path length x. Then you just have gm over b squared plus x squared to the 1/2 power. And then you can plug that in, integrate it, and you get the deflection angle, which is 4gm over b. And so 4gm over b is the deflection angle by gravity on light. And so this was the first test of Einstein's theory of general relativity, which it passed. And it just took a lot of expeditions down to Antarctica and then through the jungle and everywhere else on the planet in order for them to do it, while carrying cameras that weighed about 1,000 pounds and were like 80 feet long and stuff like that. Yeah. Exactly the kind of project you could probably have a group of middle school kids do nowadays for like 50 cents, but whatever. Anyway.
So that is the basics behind gravitational lensing. Another thing that you get is this thing called a gravitational time delay. And this happens because if you have light coming directly to you from the source, you just integrate directly over that unperturbed path. And that tells you how far away it is. What happens is you've got this extra perturbation because the light has to travel up and then back down to get to you. So you get an extra delta T, which comes from integrating that perturbation over the path. And that ends up coming out as 2 times the integral of phi ds. So you end up getting this extra delta T, and you can almost think about it as if space had an index of refraction that was non-zero, where the index of refraction is 1 minus 2 phi. So it's kind of neat because it's, you know, they're talking about astronomical distances here, but it does tell you that you can get a time delay based on the path that the light took. And so you might see a situation where, let's say you have light coming directly at you from some source far away. And then all of a sudden, a galaxy kind of is swinging around and comes between you and the source. Then there's a time delay in how long it took the light to get to you from there on out. And, you know, for long enough distances, that could amount to more and more time. And there's also a thing called microlensing where you might have things that are like smaller, like black holes or neutron stars or something like that, which might actually do some gravitational lensing. Not as big as a galaxy, but you can still do some interesting stuff with it. And then, like I said, in Chapter 8, they go into a lot more detail about how this is used in cosmology and where it might be of value and so on. Okay. All right. So now I want to get to what I think is the fun part, which is the gravitational waves. And so the idea here is that this is truly dynamical general relativity because you can actually have fluctuations in space-time, and this is another thing that absolutely does not show up in Newtonian physics. And you can see here that what you're going to do is that if it's a gravitational wave, and we're going to treat it a lot like electromagnetic radiation, where you want it to flow through a vacuum. If it's not going through a vacuum, then it doesn't necessarily mean it works. And so we have to set the T mu nu equal to zero, which is not, all right, you know, pretty much true, you know, at least to first order. And so if you set T mu nu equal to zero, so the stress energy tensor disappears, and what happens is you can see that if we were using this gauge, this transverse gauge, then that would mean that the Laplacian of psi goes to zero. The Laplacian of W goes to zero. And so things are going to simplify down a lot if we take that assumption. And you could see here, then that means that Laplacian of psi equals zero, and since we don't have singularities, psi means goes to zero. Laplacian of the vector perturbations goes to zero, which means the vector perturbations disappear. And also, you can see that the Laplacian of phi must disappear. And so that means that phi has to also drop out. So the only thing you end up left with is going to be the strain. And the strain, in this case, is going to follow wave equations. And you can see that by looking at this equation. Basically, as soon as you took these two to zero, you end up with phi equals psi, and that kind of got rid of that part. That part disappeared, this part disappeared, and you're just left with the strain equation. But the right-hand side is zero, so that disappears. And so you just have the strain equation. So we call this the transverse traceless gauge because the strain is
traceless by definition, and it, we're using a transverse gauge, though we call it transverse traceless. And so the way we write this typically is we would actually write it as if it's the perturbation tensor, but we're only really using the strain in here. And so the strain, box strain equals zero, which is the same thing as if you contract over the derivatives and over space and time on the perturbation, you get zero. And so you can solve this, because it's just a wave equation now, with plane waves. And, you know, the plane wave solution is just simply, you know, you take your derivatives, take a couple derivatives, and you get back itself, but multiplied by this minus ik squared term. And so we put this other term in front of it. This is a constant symmetric tensor, which is kind of like your amplitude. And the rest of it here is just, you know, waves. So zero is your box solution. And so you can say that's the same thing as if you take the Minkowski metric and you raise one of these terms and you're taking the second derivative. And when you take one of these derivatives on this, you get an ik term falls down. And what happens then is you take another derivative and you end up getting these other two. This other term falls down. And then you apply the Minkowski inverse metric to that, and you end up just having the k squared term. And that tells you that k is a null vector, because if you take it and you dot it with itself, you get zero, which is a definition of a null vector. And that means that gravitational waves, at least these plane waves, must move at the speed of light because they're following null vectors. Because this holds here, it's saying that gravitational waves follow null vectors because the wave numbers are orthogonal to each other or to themselves, which only happens when you talk about null vectors. And anything that follows a null vector must travel at the speed of light. Therefore, gravitational waves travel at the speed of light. Now, you can see here that if you were to put a non-zero term on the left-hand side, that would be the same thing as a gravitational wave traveling through matter. And it would be not necessarily zero, in which case it would, you know, if it's traveling through matter, it might slow down. But for traveling through a vacuum, it's going to go to the speed of light, just like light. Now, the plane wave solution, this works for a null vector. And gravitational waves, they move at or close to the speed of light. And also, you got to keep in mind, we're still doing perturbations here. These are not exact solutions. And since they're not exact solutions, then there's always a little wiggle room in the physics going on here. And so we can do what we call linearized solutions. In reality, what would happen is you would have some nonlinear terms added onto this, which are going to affect the way the gravitational waves would work. Like, you know, so things would behave a little bit differently. And I'll go into that a little bit more later. So one example here is we use the wave vector omega, k1, k2, k3, where omega is the frequency, which comes from just doing a summation over the spatial k vectors. Because this is a null vector, that has to be true. And so if we use this linearized solution, we can do something we can't normally do in general relativity, which is superimpose our waves on top of each other. And so we have also the fact that this is supposed to be transverse means that when we take the derivative of it, we get zero, which is the same thing as multiplying the wave number and contracting that with the perturbation.
And so therefore, that's the same thing as contracting this with the constant tensor. And so what that means here is that if we have a wave, and let's say it's moving in the z direction, then it's making changes in the x and y direction. So the xy plane, all the stuff is, the fields are kind of moving that way, but the wave is propagating in a z direction. The same thing an electromagnetic wave does. Except when an electromagnetic wave, it's traveling in the z direction, the x direction might be electric field, and the y direction is magnetic field. Here it's all gravitational. So we basically say if this is moving in a z direction, we've got these terms in the x and y direction. And you'll notice here that this is traceless, so that when you sum along the trace, these two terms cancel out. But these two are the same because it's symmetric. So if you have particles with the four velocity of u, mu, and they have a separation of s, mu, then what happens is you can calculate out what happens to the separation between these particles with respect to time. And a lot of that separation with time comes from the Riemann that develops between them, because they're following the curvature of space-time. And so this four velocity, let's suppose that it's such that these particles are at rest, at least in the absence of gravitational waves. And the Riemann ends up just looking like this, because all the other terms disappear to zero. Easiest you could possibly get. So what happens is the geodesic equation for these particles looks like this, and it depends just on a second derivative of the perturbation. Now, if the wave is traveling in the z direction, the particles aren't going to move in the x and y direction. So we're going to relabel C11 to be H plus and C12 to be H cross. And you can see we have, now this is our constant tensor, constant symmetric tensor. And if you take H cross equal to zero, you're going to see that what's going to happen is your motion in the one direction and your motion in your two direction are going to just depend on these plus terms. And so they're just going to be like plane waves in the plus direction. And you're going to see here that when you solve these differential equations, you're just solving two independent differential equations.
Whoops. This is supposed to be a 2 here.
My mistake. So you solve these two independent equations, and what happens is you end up with these two solutions, where you basically have the initial perturbation, or the initial value of S0, which is where the particles originally located, the original separation. And then you have a perturbation where, in, say, if this S1 is the x direction, then it's going to start off and it's going to oscillate out to a maximum. And then as this thing goes from positive to negative, it's going to come back on the other side. It's going to oscillate back and forth this way. Meanwhile, in the y direction, it's going to, as this one went out, this one's going to go in, and it's going to oscillate back and forth. And so the two are going to do the same thing at the same time. And then if you take the plus direction and you set that equal to zero, then what's going to happen is you've got your original perturbation in the x direction, and then you're going to have an extra perturbation in the y direction that's going to come in. And then vice versa, this is going to do the same thing here. And so if you look at these figures, this is a lot better than I can draw it. This is what perturbations look like for the plus polarization. And so you can see you start off with a ring of particles like this. And then it gets narrower, but then it's taller. And then it gets back to a ring, and then it gets shorter and it gets fatter. And then it goes back to a ring and it goes the other way. And it literally just keeps jogging back and forth with time.
And then you have the cross polarization, where what it does here is it starts off with the ring, but it elongates along the other way. So if you think about it, if you just kind of put this on top of this, it looks like a cross. Yeah, as opposed to this one, where you put this perturbation on top of that one, it looks like a plus sign. And so that's why we call them the plus and cross polarizations. So you can literally, do pretty well in defining why it is these things work like they do. And you can also take the plus and cross polarization, you could put them together, and you can get right and left circularly polarized waves. By just taking right polarized would mean you have the plus and you add on the imaginary part of y, of the cross, and then the other one you just subtract. Actually, this should be cross here. Yeah, I don't know why I did that. So what happens is you effectively end up with these waves, where as you can see, they sort of, it's like the oval rotates, and it's like they're spinning. Now, the neat thing about this is the particles themselves aren't spinning, but they're all going in their own little closed circles in order to make the whole thing look like it's spinning. Now, here's a neat thing. From particle physics, we can define the spin of a particle by just simply looking at the symmetry of these waves. And if you could take a wave or some kind of perturbation, and all you have to do is take 360 degrees, divide it by the angle that you have to rotate the wave around in order for it to look like itself. Then what happens is, if you look at electromagnetic wave, for example, and you've got the electric field going this way, you rotate it 90 degrees, it definitely looks different. Rotate it 180 degrees, and you could see that the electromagnetic wave is pointing in the other direction, so it's not looking the same, so you have to rotate it 360 degrees in order for it to look like itself. And so we call it a photon, which causes that electromagnetic wave, a spin one particle, because you have to spin it around once to look like itself. For spin one half particles, it would actually have to rotate around 720 degrees to look like itself. And that's what the fermions do.
As I rotate twice.
Mm-hmm. I'm not sure exactly how that works either. But when you look at gravitational waves, what happens is you have a gravitational wave and it's oscillating like this. So you rotate it around 180 degrees, it looks just like itself. And so 360 degrees divided by 180 degrees makes it spin 2. And so that's why they call gravitons spin 2 particles.
Oh, and what were fermions?
Fermions would be spin 1/2.
And they were 180.
Yeah. And then I think if you look at like strong force particles or something like that, you actually get spin zero particles, where it's basically, here it is, a spin zero particle is something where you basically can't rotate it enough to actually come back on itself. And that's sort of like the breathing mode here. So it's basically it doesn't matter, you don't have to spin it at all in order for it to look like itself, so you get this sort of a natural spin. So one reason why they like string theory so much is because it naturally, when they look at all the different vibrational modes of a string, you get spin zero modes and you get spin two modes, and the spin two modes they think correspond to gravity. And so you can, based on all these different symmetries, you can come out with the physics. Now, one word of warning is that these, again, are all linearized gravity, which means we're assuming that gravity is completely linear and that you can just sum up, add up solutions, add up gravitational waves to get what you want. And that doesn't really work in the real world. What happens in the real world is
that you have the all these other terms that we just kind of threw away are really there, and they can grow and they can do a lot of other stuff. And so gravitons in reality actually should couple to themselves because of these extra nonlinearities. And so H, mu, and U, which are these perturbations, should have their own T, mu, and U terms. And so they should have their own stress tensors, and that's going to give you extra nonlinearities, which is going to give you full general relativity. So this is just an approximation. And what happens is you'll see that some of the characteristics of a full gravitational wave are actually a little different than what you get when you make this linearity assumption. And one thing is that you don't get periodic gravitational waves. They don't exist in real life. They just exist in fantasy. Because they're coupling to themselves, so you don't actually get a full periodicity like you'd expect. Another thing is that if you actually had two gravitational waves and they actually collided, you could actually form a singularity from that because they're both curving space-time enough and they can collapse in on each other. But, you know, but it's kind of like they're so... if the perturbations are weak enough, then you don't have to really worry about that. You get stronger perturbations, then you get some interesting things. Okay. All right, now the last thing I want to talk about are sources of gravitational radiation. And what happens here is that you really want to have to be able to solve for what produced the gravitational waves in order to tell what the signature of the gravitational wave should look like. And of course, here we're doing it assuming linearized gravity. If you want to do it for nonlinear gravity, like a case of two black holes colliding or something like that, you need a computer because it gets all the extra nonlinearities come into play. But here we can assume that we just take our linearized perturbation and we just set it equal to a stress tensor and have the stress tensor being non-zero, where this is the source of the gravitational radiation. Where in this perturbation here, you see I put a little bar on top, which stands for having the perturbation that we normally would have, and then we're adding to it, or subtracting from it, H, which is a trace, then the flat space perturbation. And it's a trace reverse perturbation. And here you notice that we're not assuming that the trace is necessarily zero because we are going to have other things going on, which is going to make it hard to say that this trace is definitely, you know, that this trace is definitely zero. So this is box, and therefore the way we solve this is with our friend the Green's function. And so you would actually have to use the Green's function in order to solve this inhomogeneous equation. And so you'd solve it like the homogeneous equation, use your Green's function, and you integrate your Green's function with your stress tensor. And once you do that, skipping many, many steps, you get H bar, which is written here in terms of I, or the second derivative of I, where I is the quadrupole moment tensor. And so what I skipped over here, and they went through a lot of painstaking detail in section 7.5, was to describe how they actually did this. And so you get to see some interesting stuff here as far as how they used the Green's functions. I think they actually did like a Fourier transform, an inverse transform at some point along here. And the neat thing, we just care about results, is that this means that when we're talking about gravitational waves, the lowest order mode is a quadrupole mode. So, you know, when we talk about, electromagnetic wave caused by a single particle, if it's caused by an electron, for example, you get, you know, that's a monopole. And you can oscillate that, and you end up with this kind of a dipole mode that forms. And then you take a magnetic field vector and you shake it,
and you end up getting a quadrupole moment. And then, like here, the gravitational waves, you don't get monopoles, you don't get dipoles, it's always this quadrupole. And quadrupoles, as you know, die off a lot faster than dipoles, radiation. So what happens here is that this kind of gives you an example of why it is that these gravitational waves should be so weak compared to these other things. All right. And then, I skip a lot of stuff he did here, but he talked about energy loss and gravitational waves, and this is something that I didn't feel like I really had time to go into, but this section, I would recommend reading it, because the way that we even know or believe that these gravitational waves exist is because of a binary pulsar that was discovered, and they actually looked at the energy loss from that binary pulsar system in order to determine that there were gravitational waves being emitted. And they go through the math on that. And then I want to talk a little bit, last thing is just a little bit about the detection of gravitational waves. And, you know, this is something else that I think it's good to note. And the idea is that if you have these gravitational waves, if they actually exist, then we should be able to see them somehow. And originally there was a guy named Weber, and he decided that he wanted to detect gravitational waves, so he built this bar detector. And what they did was, it was a huge bar, and the idea was supposed to resonate at the frequency of the gravitational waves whenever they were emitted and produce these things. The problem is, well, one of the problems was that his bar was basically a high-frequency detector. And to be cryogenically cooled and everything in order to be very, very sensitive. And we found that the strongest sources of gravitational waves are actually low frequency. So maybe he'll see something, but it has to be a very, very specific event, like a supernova explosion happening not too far from us. You know, close enough to us to detect, far enough away not to kill us.
How low is low frequency?
The best chance we had of detecting gravitational waves would have been the LISA experiment, which was on the order of 0.1 hertz down to a microhertz, I think. So, on Earth, we've got these detectors. This is basically a model of the LIGO detector, where they have two of these, one in Hanford, Washington, one in Livingston, Louisiana. And what happens is, they shine a laser here, and then it goes into this splitter, and it goes down these two paths, these two mirrors, and it heats each mirror and bounces back and forth thousands of times. And then after a while, they come back through the mirrors, they're recombined, and they go into a photodiode. And this photodiode looks for the little bitty changes in the frequency, because what happens is a gravitational wave passes by, say, in the plus polarization, it should cause this arm to get longer and this one to get shorter, and vice versa. And so that they're looking for that little change in distance, and that little change in distance shows up as a difference in a mismatch in the frequencies. And so this these arms that they're doing this with are 4 kilometers long for the U.S. experiment.
You mean that L is equal to 4 kilometers?
Yeah, L is equal to 4 kilometers. And the idea, though, is that you're doing this on Earth, and so you're kind of limited what frequencies you can go after. And so the sweet spot on this is around 100 hertz. And they can go maybe as low as 10 hertz. If you go below 10 hertz, there's a lot of low-frequency seismic noise that we don't normally detect that can ruin a signal. And a good example of this is called the microseismic peak, which is something that only geologists and surfers know about.
Surfers?
Yeah. Well, apparently,
surfers, geologists.
Once every 6 seconds, a wave comes in and hits the shore.
Oh, okay.
And so geologists know this because every time they're taking geological data, all these waves hitting the shore causes big spike at this this frequency, which is like around 0.1 hertz or something like that. The surfers know this because they're out there trying to time the wave, and they know, okay, missed that one, next wave, 6 seconds.
So that's how they know that. So that limits you to low frequencies, and also low frequencies are harder to filter out. And also another thing is that, like, with these experiments, since you're looking for gravitational waves, anytime you have a mass and it moves, it's creating gravitational waves. So even though this mirror, this thing is incredibly sensitive and it can detect all these gravitational waves, you walking by might be enough to disturb the mirror because of your gravitational attraction.
And so what they're looking at is the strain, H, that they're looking for is on the order of 10 to the minus 21 when you get into that frequency range. And this is for solar mass black holes colliding as a potential source or something like that, which means that delta L over L is equal to 10 to the minus 21. And so what that means is that if you take 4 kilometers, and I think they work it out here somewhere, if you assume that your arms are 4 kilometers long, then
top of that page.
Yeah. Then that gives you the delta L is equal to this in centimeters, which is 10 to minus 13. So it's pretty tiny. So you're basically looking at something on about a thousandth the diameter of an atomic nucleus. And you have to be able to detect it from 4 kilometers away. So, anyway, that's why I'm not an experimentalist.
So this means the Earth is flying through the universe, and we're going to go through a wave like a boat, like a one boat going through another boat's wave wake.
Mm-hmm.
So we're hoping that we'll go through the wake of some previous explosion and sense it.
Well, the thing is, it's going to go through us eventually, because if you think about it, these are still traveling at the speed of light. And so if you're looking at something in the order of 100 hertz traveling at the speed of light, even though the Earth is moving, you're still going to be able to detect this motion. And also, you got to keep in mind also that, like, this thing is set up here for the plus polarization, effectively, that the waves come in just like, you know, this is Y and this is X. What happens if it's in a cross polarization? You don't see as much.
Why didn't they do a Z? I mean, didn't they do a second one that was in...
Yeah, well, that's why the U.S., they built 2 detectors. So that they have one in this configuration, they have another one in another configuration, and they can check each other. Because at this level of accuracy, it could just be shot noise from the laser. It could be, these aren't cooled, so you get thermal noise. You could get a little imperfection in the mirror. If you're hanging these mirrors by rope, you can have little noise that comes from the fibers in the rope. You can have...
You really need one 90 degrees around the Earth.
Mm-hmm.
So you have the X, Y, and Z planes.
Yeah, and that's why they got another detector in Italy. There is one, like in Pisa, Italy. There's one in Germany. There's one in Japan. And there's one in... they're actually talking about moving... The Hanford, Washington detector actually had 2 interferometers in it. And they're talking about moving one to Australia. Because in Australia, they actually had a gravitational wave detection set up down there, which wasn't nearly as big. And, you know, move it down there so that they can get another site. And so you need all these things working together and detecting, and then if somebody detects something, you can compare it to the other ones.
Did somebody do a calculation to figure out how frequently we're going to be going through these waves?
Yeah. Yeah, and a lot of that depends on the size of the wave, the amplitude, a lot of other stuff like that. If you're talking about for these ground-based detectors, and you're talking about having a sensitivity of 10 to the minus 21, which I think There's a sensitivity graph in here. Yeah, here it is. So here's the sensitivity graph for LIGO. And if you're assuming you have this sensitivity and then they had to upgrade it to advanced LIGO to really get it down to this level. And what happens is if you have neutron, neutron, star, or black hole binaries, they're going to come out around this frequency range. And the lower frequency, you can see the higher amplitude, the source. What happens is a lot of this depends on how far away the source is. Like, if it's too far away, the amplitude's died off too much for us to even be able to hear it. If it's, it's got to be in the right mass range, you know, like solar mass black holes. If it's like a, you know, just one black hole and it's, you know, has a planet crash into it, it's probably not going to be enough for us to hear it. And so there's a lot of other factors like that. So they actually tried to do calculations by basically making a lot of assumptions about how many black holes there are in our solar system and or in our galaxy, and then how many of them are in binary systems, and how many of these binary systems are in the stage where they might be collapsing into each other to create detectable gravitational waves. And what happened is you come up with a number from that, and you know it could be on the order of a neutron star binary collision, which is close enough for us to hear, might only happen like once every 20 years.
If that, yeah.
And so what you do is you increase the sensitivity, and that increases the range. And now you're not just talking about our galaxy, you're also talking about neighboring galaxies. And that gives you a little bit better odds. And so it works out to where you can keep increasing it until you get to something partly reasonable. And it's like where even if everything is perfect, you still might not expect to see a frequency, even if you get to the perfect sensitivity. It could still be 5 years before you hear anything, if everything's even working perfect. Now, LISO, on the other hand, was designed to be the perfect experiment. It was going to have a sensitivity of basically looking for supermassive black holes, which produce much bigger frequencies at much lower, much lower frequencies with much higher amplitudes. And you could see the colliding, these black hole ranges are way up here. And these things, not only could they detect the collisions of supermassive black holes, which should take place anytime you have galaxies colliding, but they should also take place anytime you have, you know, stuff falling into a supermassive black hole, which would cause it to ring, and it could actually detect those because they'd be in the right frequency range. And the range for LISA would have been the same as the range for any telescope on the planet, which has been, you could have seen all the way out to the edge of the visible universe. So if there would have been any black hole collision of that mass, LISA would have saw it. And if LISA didn't see anything, it meant that there's nothing out there. And those collisions would probably, you know, they could be happening all the time. Plus, it could actually detect things like some of the ring down noise from the early universe, stuff like that. So that was the goal. And unfortunately, the NASA doesn't have money to support it, so forget about that. The European Space Agency is now basically redesigning LISA and trying to get it to fit within their budget, and they're going to be running it. And then hopefully they'll get something that won't quite be as good as the design specs for LISA, but they're hoping to hit most of the science. So it'll be a lot better. And the whole idea of LISA was where LIGO, you had these two arms and this interferometer. With LISA, it was going to be three spaceships, and they were going to be flying in formation, and then shining lasers between each other. And every time a gravitational wave came by, it would lengthen the arm or shorten the other arm, and they could detect that by, you know, basically just looking at how far the lasers are. So, anyway, that was the idea. All right. So, any questions for this stuff? All right. So Thursday, we're going to be talking about cosmology, and that's going to be closing out the semester here.
Chapter 8.
And I think we should be able to, we should be in pretty good shape with all this, as far as what else is being covered. And then I'd like to get the final exam turned in to me Tuesday. And so you could basically just drop it off in my office on Tuesday. And like I said before, you can communicate general questions to each other, no specifics. That means, you know, don't show somebody your paper and say, look, how do I do this? But if you can describe it in words, you can. That's fair game.
The exam's closed business Tuesday.
Yeah. Yeah, close of business Tuesday. And like I said before, everybody is pretty much on track to do pretty well. It's just a matter of, you know, do well on your final exam and you should be okay in the class. And five problems. The ones from Chapter 7 is all on stuff that I covered today. So it should be no surprises. The ones for Chapter 8 are going to be stuff we're going to talk about on Thursday. And I think I pretty much cover everything. We're going to be, for the cosmology stuff, we're effectively going to cover everything except for the inflation stuff at the end and some of the stuff that deals specifically with our universe. Okay. All right.
Who cares about our universe?
Well, you guys already live there. You know, you already know
what I'm familiar with.